you got to be able to use the full range of emotion. And so there's a lot of leadership books, a lot of advice about how should you be? Should you, you know, obviously Steve Jobs was a drive, demand, insist, push person who was tremendously successful. And there are other models of leaders. And there's a lot in popular culture of management that you, the preferred style would be much more collaborative pulling. What I've learned is if the most effective leaders can toggle between the two. There's a time when they drive, demand, and insist, but they're not stuck there. And they also have the agility to move over into a more collaborative pulling style.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Higher Standard Podcast, where we give you ultra premium, unfiltered truth when it comes to building your wealth and curating the lifestyle of your dreams. No games, no drama, and no shenanigans. I am your host, Chris Nahibi, and I'm here to help you distill the immense amount of information and disinformation out there on the interwebs and give you the opportunity to choose a higher standard for yourself. There are no gurus here, and no one gives a damn about how wealthy you look. I'm an attorney and a banker, amongst other things. Does that mean you should listen to me? Hell no. This is just full disclosure that while we talk about money, wealth, law, investing, and a lot of related topics, you should always speak to your own advisors for an opinion tailored to your unique investment perspective. I am obligated to tell you that nothing contained in this show is in fact legal or investment advice and is being provided solely for entertainment purposes. So sit back, relax your mind, and get ready for a different kind of podcast where we elevate your baseline in crispy, high-resolution audio. This isn't a different standard. It's the higher standard. Hey, friends. Welcome back. This week, I have an exciting podcast for you. For me personally, it's exciting because this gentleman is not just somebody I'm having on the show. He's a friend. He's been a guy who mentored me. I know a lot of times you hear, oh, coach, mentor, you think online context. No, Roger Lipson, the amazing Roger Lipson, is not like that. He is not like anything or anyone you've ever experienced. And of that, I can assure you. And you will figure that out within 5 minutes of listening to our interview. But what I will say is Roger and I go back. For those of you who don't know me, I entered into sarcastically a program at Yale called the Global Executive Leadership Program. I did not expect to get in. I got accepted. One of the parts of that program was you do something called an LMAP. For those of you who are, you know, in the business world, you took something called the Gallup Strengths Finder. I've taken that at multiple different times at multiple different organizations where it kind of gives you your personality profile and how you interact with one another in the corporate environment. Roger was there. He was part of that program, part of building it. And he built something called the LMAP, which in my mind was a much more, at least for me, successful look into how I interact with my colleagues at the office. And how I could better myself, my strengths, my weaknesses. It told me a lot about myself. But the most powerful part of the LMAP was that in this program, I got to sit with Roger Lipson in this room and go over all these things and really have this open-hearted conversation. And for anybody who's ever been to like therapy or something like that, where you sit down and, you know, across from somebody and you open up, it's very rare where you can do that in the business sense and talk about your fears, your strengths, your weaknesses, and how they all interact in your family and trying to get to that next level. But you can do it with somebody who's had the exposure to as many super successful people as Roger has. And Roger is such a humble dude. He's not going to name drop all of the people that he's met along the way, 25 plus years in this business, Fortune 500 companies. And he isn't going to name drop these big names, but I will. Because I'm that guy. I'll do that. Yale, Walt Disney Company, TD Ameritrade, Teach for America. I mean, a lot of big, big companies and a lot of really well-known people that he and I have spoken about that he would never, you know, violate their trust and confidence that I'll tell you right now, this man, if anybody is going to be able to tell you what some of the traits of success look like and give you some perspective into how you should perceive your own strengths, weaknesses, success, failures, whatever that might be. Roger took me at a time where I was seriously questioning what my next level was, what my personal growth would be. And I didn't realize it when I left that conversation. I knew that we were going to be friends for a long time. Pizza and beer was a definite thing. I didn't realize at the time he was also a BMW guy and geeks out on cars. He just picked up an awesome 5 Series. We'll talk a little bit about that at the end. But I didn't realize how long-lasting the impacts would be. It is true, my real estate company would not be officially built and growing the way that it is today if it weren't for Roger's influence. And this podcast, believe it or not, would not be here today if I didn't feel the need to really get out there and change the paradigm. And in my world as a banker, you don't do this. You're not out there socially. You're not out there doing these things. It's this old school stigma. You're not supposed to be that guy. You're not supposed to be out there as a face, but I am. And Roger's the guy who helped me get there. Love him for what he's done for me. I really love this podcast episode, not the least reason of which is because I get to talk to a friend and share some of the experiences that I've had with him, with you guys, and I hope it's helpful. I understand that some of these tests, they got a stigma to them, and not everybody loves them and buys into them, but I have a feeling if you're listening to this podcast and you know I'm a kind of a no bullshit guy, I'm not going to steer you wrong on this, you're really, really, really going to enjoy this conversation with Roger. I hope you take from it at least a little bit of what I did, and hope it helps you level up. Let's listen to Roger. How are you, bud?
I am good.
So we are recording. We are live. For those of you out there who don't know Roger, Roger Lipson is a stud for many, many, many reasons of which we are going to get into. But he is a friend. He is a friend, a colleague, somebody that I deeply respect, and he has mentored me to try to push to kind of the next level. And for a lot of reasons, he's kind of the inspiration for this podcast, although he doesn't know it. How are you, Roger?
I am well, and I did not know that.
No, you did not know that, but that's by design, because how can I capture your raw emotion if I don't talk to you about how we got here?
My actual surprise.
Yeah. So if you could help the listeners understand what it is that you do, and I will obviously explain before this, you know, who and what you are, but to hear it straight from your mouth and to hear the complexities of how you interact with so many professionals, I think is fascinating.
Yeah. So the thing that I do that I'm probably most well known for is my executive coaching. So it's a culmination of really my entire career. And so I spent the first large chunk of my career studying what made people successful. So I was at Gallup, and we had this really unique interviewing process. And we helped companies find more people like the ones that they had hired that they said, these are our best people. So we had a methodology where we would go to a company, let's say it was a pharmaceutical company, and they'd say, we need to hire better sales reps. And so we'd say, all right, well, do you have some sales reps now? And of course, they always did. Yeah, big sales force. And I said, well, can we meet with some of the best ones you've got? So they might have, you know, a big company like Merck or GlaxoSmithKline, they might have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. And we'd say, well, can we meet with some of the best ones? And so we'd do focus groups. We'd meet with small groups of 7 to 10 high performers. And we'd just ask them a bunch of questions and try to figure out what would make them tick. And then from that, we'd put together a pilot interview, an interview, maybe 200 questions, far too long to be used in a selection environment or if you were a recruiter. And we would test out all these questions, and we would look for the questions where the most talented people would talk a little bit differently in a way that we could capture. So if the high performers were talking a little bit differently than a contrast group that we would ask those same questions of, and those the contrast group was really, they were just average performers. So we'd go in and we'd test out all these questions, and we'd compare the responses of the highest performers to the middle and below average performers. And we'd say, hey, can we figure out what's going on here? And so we'd have a lot of success with this. And so we'd come up with a set of questions that then our bet was that if we went out and talked to candidates and applied those same questions, if we heard some of those same patterns, if we heard people talking in the similar way of the high performers, then we're like, okay, well, maybe, you know, if it kind of walks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, maybe we've got a duck. And so it sounds pretty simple. There was a lot of science behind it, a lot of statistical analysis and research. But that's what we did. And we would group these questions into traits like achievement drive and focus and responsibility and relator and developer. And all these buzzwords had definitions. So I did that. And originally I did it in the food service and hospitality industry. And then I branched out, and our company started branching out and doing it in all different kinds of sales. And then we studied everything from generals in the military to physicians at the Mayo Clinic to oil rig workers in the Gulf of Mexico. So one of the interesting projects that I did, you know, I got this great job. I get to go around and study high performers and So I had this client, and it was called Ogden Allied Services. I don't know, they still exist. And their job, they were a contract services company. And what they would do is they would hire people to go do the lowest jobs of the low on an oil rig, for example. So doing the laundry and working in the kitchen. And early on in the company's history, they said they would literally in New Orleans, they would go to Skid Row and they would take people off of Skid Row and say, hey, you want to go work on an oil rig for a couple of weeks and make some money? And they'd ship them off to the rig, and they were almost like indentured slaves, and they would work. And that's how they actually got their employees in the beginning of the company. So obviously things had evolved, but they were still really struggling. It was a really high turnover job. And they were saying, hey, could you help us? And I said, well, it's kind of a unique challenge. So I said, well, you know, I probably need to understand a little bit more about the job. And so I actually went out and I actually worked in the kitchen on an oil rig in the Gulf for 3 days, which was pretty fascinating. And but I got to meet, I say these guys, because at that time on the oil rigs, it was still all men. So it was an all male environment that was changing right at the time that I did the project. But at that time, it was an oil rig was an all male environment. And so I'm doing these focus groups. So I'm meeting with 7 to 10 of what they said were their high performers. So it turns out everybody in the room was an ex-con.
Oh.
And these guys, you know, so it starts off pretty rough, Chris, because so here I am, I'm this shrink with this consulting company. And, you know, these guys are, you know, these are tough dudes. And, you know, they're ex-cons. They kind of look like they, you know, just walked off the set of a movie, kind of stereotypical.
I mean, you kind of are a badass, but I'm venturing to guess you're probably a little light on tattoos.
Yeah. And, you know, these, and so I didn't really have the matching look, right? And so there, you know, a lot of people sitting back, arms crossed, pretty skeptical, but I got them talking and I started asking them about their work. And what I really learned from that project was, you know, every job has dignity. And my old mentor used to say the work can be the finest expression of a human being. And so I would ask them questions about what they were doing. And one guy with tears in his eyes, he said, this job saved my life. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, so, you know, when you get out of prison, you're not ready to be in the world. You're not ready to be in society. And you get in a lot of trouble. So all of a sudden, you can start drinking again. You know, it's a whole different environment. And you come out of prison and you have problems with controlling yourself. And he said, that job, if I hadn't been able to go on that oil rig, and so their schedule was 3 weeks on, 1 week off. So it turns out that the oil rig is like a halfway house. So being on an oil rig for 3 weeks where there are no drugs, alcohol, no members of the opposite sex really limits the amount of trouble that you can get into. And this guy basically said, he said, if I hadn't had that job, he said, I would have gotten killed. I either would have overdosed or I would have gotten in a fight and I probably wouldn't be here. And so it turns out that the rig actually served this function of being almost like a halfway house for these ex-cons. But they took as much pride in their work as any job description I've ever studied, as much as a stockbroker on Wall Street, as much as a doctor at the Mayo Clinic. There was a guy, and I said, yeah, they're going around and asking him their names. And he said, well, you know, my name's thus and such. He said, but they call me Patches. And I said, well, why do they call you Patches? And he said, well, you know, on the oil rig, the actual rig workers, you know, they look kind of like a flight suit. And they've got all their patches and stuff on them for their company. But it's kind of a rough environment. There's a lot of metal out there, a lot of sharp edges. And so during the course of their work, you know, their patches would come off and start to pull off of their uniform. And my job's to do the laundry. And I just noticed that these patches didn't look very good. And so I just got a needle and thread and I started sewing the patches back on when I was doing the laundry. And people, they really appreciated that. And then guys would start bringing me their uniforms with their new patches or their name or whatever they wanted on there. And I would sew them on. They'd pay me a little extra money. So I got the nickname Patches. And then there was another guy I was talking about. Well, I said, well, what do you do? He goes, well, I kind of work in the kitchen. I kind of help out. I kind of keep the dining area clean. And he's talking more about that. And he said, you know, these guys work really hard. It's hot out there on the rig. It's cold. It can be windy. It can be wet. And when they come in, the last thing they should have to worry about when they're sitting down to eat is whether there's a toothpick on the table. So I make sure everything's exactly the way it should be. The toothpick holder's full. There's plenty of napkins. Because with the work they're doing, they don't need to worry about that stuff. And one by one, and these were the top performers, they all had a way of expressing themselves and communicating the pride they took in their job and the importance of what they did. So I got to do this for 20 years to study all these job descriptions and go out and spend my time with people that were really good at something. So, and again, they could have been it could have been a physician at the Mayo Clinic. It could have been an oil rig worker. It could have been a restaurant manager. So I got a lot of reps at being around really high performing people, hearing them talk about what they do. And that gave me this really tremendous background that after doing this for long enough and the other different kinds of work that I had done, when I went out on my own in 2002, I started to get these calls about what I do. People talked to me and I got these executive coaching opportunities. I got one really key one in the beginning with a publicly traded company that really kind of launched me, where I started to figure out, okay, I can really do this. So after I hung my shingle out, it was something that just kind of fell in my lap initially. And now it's a really big chunk of what I do. So, but it all comes back to this idea that what are the patterns of successful people and all the cumulative things that I've learned about high performers and how they operate. And then when I'm spending time with people with coaching, it's a lot of listening and a little bit of coaching, but it's always tapping back into, what is this person really good at? What are their talents? What are their strengths? How do I reinforce those? How do I help them be the best version of who they are? But at the same time, do they have some counterproductive patterns, some things that are getting in the way, or some things that could potentially derail their career, and addressing those things pretty directly as well?
So, I mean, that's got to be a difficult thing, right? You have these high performers who are in their industry. These people are, you know, used to that level of performance production and the accolades that come along with it. Trying to tell somebody, hey, you can do better, but X, Y, and Z needs some improvement. How is that reception generally?
You know, the people I work with are highly motivated, and I tell them some things right up front. So maybe this has to do with who I am and the setup that I do with my coaching. So I tell them right out of the box. I said, hey, you're paying me too much money to tell you what you want to hear. And frankly, as a senior executive, you've already got people around you that are doing that. So my job is to give you the unvarnished truth. I don't know if you remember who Karen Hughes was. Karen Hughes was an advisor for George Bush in his first administration. She had worked with him down in Texas. And I always remember reading this article about her. And Karen Hughes kept a piece of wood on her desk, an unvarnished piece of wood. And that was her reminder that her job, she was one of the few people that could walk into the president's office and give him the unvarnished truth.
Oh, and so wow.
I always think of that analogy. And I tell my clients, I said, hey, so I'm going to come in here and I'm going to call it like I see it. I'm an outside pair of eyes looking in, but I'm not going to pull any punches. And if you don't like it, if you want to shoot the messenger, that's fine. I'm a consultant. I'll go down the road and I'll start working with somebody else. But you're paying me too much money to just blow smoke or to tell you what you already want to hear. So I set it up from the beginning that I'm going to be really blunt with them and really direct. And I don't even know, that's just how I operate. And I don't even know where I came up with that initial monologue that I give people when I start with them. But I always start with that, say, hey, this is what we're here to do. And, you know, that doesn't mean it doesn't come up that often. You know, I don't have to beat people up, but at the same time, you know, I do address things head on, and it's hard. Sometimes I have to cork up the courage. I'm going to go meet with somebody and I know we're going to have a really hard conversation. It might be telling a father in a large family owned business that I don't think their son or daughter is going to be cut out to be a successor and to take over that business, even though I know that's what they want to have happen. That's a really hard conversation to have.
That's terrible. But it happens a lot though, right? I mean, second generation.
Like, it's one of the most important things, you know, to sometimes it's a, I might find out from the son or daughter that they're not really, they finally just say, you know what? I'm really not sure this is for me. Or I don't know how to tell my dad that I really don't want to be in this business. And so I'll say, well, let's have that conversation together. I said, the three of us can sit down and I'll help. So you know, those there are hard conversations in what I do, but it's pretty well received, Chris. When you say, you know, it could be tough and maybe not well received, yeah, that's what I'm there to do, and that's what they hire me to do. So that doesn't mean there aren't speed bumps along the way, but ultimately, I think people and most people end up thanking me for the help.
Well, I certainly found it, you know, helpful, and you know, for everybody's edification, we originally met through Yale's program, and we had a small interaction in the very beginning where we, you know, kind of went through some of these motions, and I found it profound. I mean, just a small, brief conversation that we had me thinking a lot about my own personal development and growth. But I think for everybody else's, you know, insight, it would be fascinating to hear some of the commonalities that you see that make people, you know, that really define people that are in that space. If you're a leader, whether you're on that oil platform or not, like, what is it that you see that are common traits? Because I think one of the biggest gaps that the next generation has is that there's a new concept of work. There's a new concept of professionalism. I mean, it used to be based on attire and how you carry yourself, but so much of that is done from home now, and you don't really interact with, you know, anybody face to face anymore. I mean, what are those traits, and do you think they can carry forward?
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about high performers in any endeavor. If someone had listened to the conversation you and I just had, where I explained my background, and that sometimes someone might stop me and say, "Well, Roger, so you've studied high performers in this incredible range of industries and job descriptions. Is there anything that's universal? Are there traits that you just see that come up over and over again? Is there anything that's kind of like a universal characteristic?" And the closest thing that I can say to that, the one that's pretty universal in high performers, is achievement drive. And so, you know, really being a high achiever, never really being satisfied with how well you're doing, and always wanting to do more, to do better. And it's an intrinsic quality, right? So the people that have this, it's from the inside out. There's nobody telling them they have to do this. It's the voice in their own head. So what we say about high achievers is they're really their own worst enemy. They're their own taskmaster. So they're harder on themselves than a boss could ever be. And they hold themselves internally to these really high standards. And they just push themselves in a way that makes them stand out. So it's sort of classic overachievement kind of behavior. And boy, if you study the top producers, the high achievers, or the most successful people in any endeavor, there's some version of this that's operating. Yeah, a little bit of it's, you know, there's no substitute for hard work. And these are people that are just really hard workers, and but they're driven from the inside out. So we love these people as employers, because I always say a high achiever, it's almost like they have their own little nuclear fuel rods. You know, as a leader or a manager of this kind of person, you never have to sort of crack the whip. You never have to press or prod or push, because this person's already driving themselves from the inside out. The old adage, what is this person doing when they're by themselves? If they're working from home and nobody's watching and there's quote unquote no supervision, well, you never really worry about that with a really high achiever, because they're holding themselves to that really high internal standard.
But is there, so I was having this conversation last night with somebody, and we were talking about how hard I am on myself. And I admit that I'm super hard on myself. And I find that that's also kind of the converse side of that skill, or that asset, if you want to call it that. Is that if you're constantly finding your own motivation and you want to constantly better improve yourself, that's a never-ending self-fulfilling prophecy where you're just continuing to try to push the limits, because you don't know where that finish line is. To me, there isn't one. Does that make sense?
Right. And that's a great point, Chris, because this is a quality of highly successful, high-performing people. That doesn't mean that there aren't negative consequences, or there isn't a flip side to this that you need to be mindful of. And this is my job. I work with these people every day. And so it's the old adage that it's the dose that makes the poison, right? So being achievement driven is great. But if you can't manage that or balance it with some other things, it can have some really negative consequences. There can be that sense of lack of fulfillment that you feel like, well, you keep pushing yourself and you keep going for that next thing and trying to do more. And at some point there may be some disillusionment, about, well, where am I going with all this? Or what am I doing? Especially if it's not combined with some sense of mission or purpose around what you're doing. So, you know, it's sort of achievement for the sake of achievement and just driving forward without any sense of purpose or meaning. So there's some other things that have to come into play in order for it to be expressed in a healthy way. But unbridled achievement drive absolutely can be have some negative consequences or have some liabilities associated with it or some things that you need to manage.
So I think the classic, you know, kind of mindset as it relates to, you know, somebody who's successful in corporate America is like, you know, the struggles they have with their family and their friends. I mean, do you see, I know personally, I struggle with friendship in the traditional sense in that I'm constantly busy and like we all get pulled in multiple directions, right? But I've always been so willing to sacrifice that time because I know that I'm giving it back to my family. I know that I'm giving it back to the job and to my other family, the work family. And that work family has been so critical for me. But, you know, is that a thing you think you see from a lot of these people where there's that subtle balance of trying to figure out how to maintain these relationships because there's such a focus on the business one?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's very difficult to find that balance point where you're going to be an all-star and you're going to be a top performer, yet you're going to try and do it in a way where you have some semblance of balance with the other things that are important to you in your life. And again, that idea that work can be the finest expression of a human being. It's funny that you bring this up. I was talking to a woman the other day and she works for a client of mine and she's just the amount of time she's putting the effort into her work that it's just insane. And I was asking her about this. I said, wow, so, you know, you've got kids, you've got a husband, and how are you managing all of that given the number of hours that you're putting in at work? And she said, oh, well, you know, they give me a hard time about that all the time. You know, they're always saying, oh, mom, you work too much. Or my husband will say, oh, you're working too much. And, you know, I've been told that my whole life. But you know what? I'm a worker. That's what I do. And
totally,
you know, I
relate
tell
to
them,
that.
Hey, that, yeah, I know you say that. I said, but also, that's also the reason why you guys have nice stuff too. And so, you know, they give me a hard time about it, but it is who I am. And it's almost like she can't not, when you are really onto a person's strengths or talents, it's not just what they can do. It's really what they're compelled to do. I mean, she can't not do it. And she told me it's not this company because I've only known her as she's worked for this particular client. And she said, this has been me my entire life. Ever since I was 14 years old, got my first job. I've just been a worker. I've always worked a lot and I like it. And so she was really unapologetic about it, but she did say that it's not without consequence and there's not some fallout with her family. So
good for her for being that cognizant of it.
I wish I was that cavalier.
You know, I wish I had that level of, I guess, bravado about it. I do feel like I'm letting people down sometimes.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen one of these, you see one of these surveys in a magazine and it says, answer these questions to find out if you're a workaholic. And you answer the first three yes, and then you peek down at the bottom and it says, if you answered yes to four or more, and you're only three questions into the survey.
Yeah, I know what I am. Yeah.
Oh, I don't even want to finish now because I know what it's going to tell me.
That survey's wrong. They don't know anything. Yeah.
So I think for each person, so how do we translate this into some realistic advice for the people that might be listening? So I think you got to be honest with yourself. If you're somebody that needs, you know, 8 to 9 hours of sleep every night, and you've got a bunch of interests outside of work, and you're really big on balance, you just have to acknowledge, you know what? In the classic sense of being a super high achiever, I might just be kind of in the middle. And I have to kind of be honest about what that means in terms of my career and what I can accomplish and the kinds of jobs that I am going to find fulfilling and what I can do. And so, and then there's other people that are beating themselves up, maybe somebody like yourself, who's a really, really hard worker and is putting in a lot of hours. And they're reading all this stuff about, you know, remember the book about, a 4-hour work week and all this stuff about how you can be so successful and get all this stuff done and not actually put in the work. Well, you know,
which is one of the biggest farces.
Yeah. It's really, there is no substitute for hard work. And if you're a worker, then you're getting a lot of feedback that says, oh, you're a workaholic, or why don't you take more vacations? And so there's a lot of pressures for that person. So the person who's maybe more middle of the pack is feeling guilty, like, well, I see all these profiles of these really successful people. And I used to work with a guy, and he'd say, the formula for making $1 million is interesting, given what you're working on. The formula for making $1 million in real estate is pretty well known. I mean, you can go to a seminar with a bunch of high producing realtors that are all multi-million dollar producers that are making tons of money. And you can say, well, how do you do what you do? And it's pretty well documented. And, you can go to seminars on this stuff. So it's one of these things, it's pretty obvious, but not very many people can actually do it.
That's the crossover, though.
Insanely hard.
Yeah. It's the crossover of that tangible difference of somebody telling you what it takes and you actually doing what it takes. There are so few people that are willing to do, to make those sacrifices, that are willing to do it. And it's not lost on me that I've had those conversations, as a matter of fact, the reason why I really ramped up my own real estate business was because of that conversation we had at Yale. I was determined by the next time I saw you that I had a contingency plan for business. But even somebody who works as hard as I do and as long as I do, it took me a couple of years to get, some real traction with the business. And it's funny to think that we all know what it takes. It's just that we all don't want to wait for it to happen.
Well, and you said something interesting, that people aren't willing to do it.
Yeah.
I would argue they're not able. I mean,
wow.
Again, for somebody like you with tremendous grit and willpower and drive, you're making the assumption that it's, people just don't want it bad enough. They just don't have the will to apply themselves to do this. But I would argue that what you're doing is natural for you. Yes, it takes grit and willpower and drive, but that's essential to your wiring and to your DNA. So there are other people that, trying to get them, even if they try and will themselves to do it, they might physically get ill. I don't know if you've ever seen somebody in a job that they weren't a good fit for, but they were really gritty.
Yeah.
And they were really determined, and they just kind of kept saying, I just got to try harder. I just got to push myself. I just got to work harder. And sometimes you can even see them over time before your eyes physically deteriorate. I worked with a woman, she started losing her hair.
I've seen that too. It's astonishing to think that internalized stress can do that to a human. It's visually very scary. I mean, I literally watched an older woman start chain smoking, start losing hair, and get very, very like nervous, neurotic like tics. It's funny in hindsight how much that I know that I am perceived by a lot of people to be an asshole, and maybe it's because I don't understand that people don't have the same capacity. And maybe that's because I'm not an arrogant person. I don't believe that I'm special in any way, shape, or form, but maybe that's what it is. But I have seen that. And it's funny, you write those off as instances that are unique, but they're really not that unique, I guess.
So a couple of things that I thought about that I thought might be helpful to our listeners that are along the lines of, hey, what are some things that, some really key things that I picked up on in my coaching, and some nuggets that I could pass on that might be helpful to people. So one of the things, after you've kind of figured out this achievement drive piece and just what kinds of work fits me in terms of how much effort I can put in and what makes me feel good and energized versus what would wear me out, then the next thing is, I always have people ask me about, should they be in leadership, management, what should they do? And you got to make the first decision, especially if you're young. Do I want to be an individual producer, or do I want to try and manage other people? So that's the first big split. And everybody thinks that as you move up that, okay, I'm automatically going to get into management. But if you're going to get into management, you have to really say, do I get a satisfaction from seeing other people grow and develop? So it's really the difference between being a player and being a coach. And there are a lot of great players that aren't very good coaches and don't get a lot of satisfaction out of being a great coach. The classic that you see in sales is, we're getting a little better at this, but for all of my career, I still see this mistake being made over and over again. We take our top salesperson and we make him or her a sales manager.
Yep. Classic
fail.
It often results
in disaster. It's like saying, hey, because you're a great player on the team, we're going to make you the coach. And if you use the sports metaphor, you immediately realize, okay, that would be a big mistake. and there are lots of examples in coaching. Now, some sports are different. So like basketball is a little different, where sometimes the point guard, the player coach. So there's kind of some hybrid models where some of the best players do actually end up making pretty good coaches. But for the most part, if you look at in professional sports, and even collegiate sports, what you find is the best coaches were pretty good players, but they were rarely were they the true superstars.
There's such usually another secret ingredient nugget out there for this. And I want to pause here because Scottie Pippen just wrote a book. And in the book, he talks about Jordan's The Last Dance special that just came out. And he tackles a little bit of this in his book. And some of it was released online, you know, through GQ and some other places last night, little tidbits here and there. But he really digs into the difference between a strong player and an actual coach, and how toxic one can be versus, you know, how helpful another can be. It's a fascinating read. I just thought it's well timed that you mentioned it in here.
Yeah, and so there are so many times where you see this happen. So if you think you might want to be a manager, and then eventually into leadership, you really have to say, how interested am I in other people? And everybody kind of chuckles nervously. It's like, oh, well, who's not interested in other people? I said, well, if you're honest with yourself, a lot of people aren't interested in other people. I mean, they're really interested in themselves. And their main source of energy from other people is competing against them, but not necessarily collaborating or not necessarily helping that other person be better. And so do you really like the process of coaching? You know, a lot of very high producing, and Michael Jordan as an example, going back to The Last Dance and the business equivalent. If I just said to you, I said, Chris, so do you think the most successful people in business are patient or impatient?
I would say they're probably patient.
Really? See, I think most.
I just want to throw you a curveball. Because we know that I'm impatient as hell.
Right. And so, you know, part of being an activator is you can't wait to make things happen. Things can't happen fast enough. You're always pushing the pace.
Well, I just can't wait. And then the irony is in business is I get so frustrated with like little tiny things. And society has made my issue worse. I'll be the first to admit. Now with Amazon getting packages to you so quick and like their email technology, if I send you a text message and you don't respond to me within that day, like I get pissed. And that's crazy when you think about it. People have lives, they have responsibility, but I don't know if it's just because like the increasing problem, but yeah, I have zero patience for things that should be resolved. And it leads to me doing things that I shouldn't be doing because I don't want to wait for somebody else to do it.
Right. So I would argue that the most successful people in many industries, most industries, are more impatient than patient. So I have a client that their whole business model is based on impatience. So everything in their business model says, if we do it faster, we make more money and we're better. So I like to joke that in their culture, impatience is a virtue. We know the biblical saying that patience is a virtue. In this company, impatience is a virtue. But they have ridiculously high turnover. They burn through people because here's what I've learned. It's very hard to find someone in that culture who's a real developer of other people. Because developers, people that are good at coaching and have an interest in seeing other people grow and succeed, usually are more patient. And so I always say in their model, hey, it's great to be super impatient, but when it comes to people, people require patience because people don't develop on a schedule and it's messy and it's two steps forward and one step back. And so there's an unevenness to how people develop. And if you're impatient with people, then that usually detracts from your ability to be an effective coach. And so there are all these paradoxes of, you know, your own personalities. And am I really, maybe I'm a top producer. Maybe I'm a great, I guarantee you that the best realtors are not patient people.
They're not. And they're hyper aggressive. They don't have an attention to detail. They have somebody else in the office to handle it for them. They want to be out chopping it up, getting the next deal. And oftentimes before the last deal is even done.
What's the old adage? I'll hunt it and I'll kill it, but you have to skin it and bring it home.
Yeah,
exactly. Somebody else has to do the paperwork.
And for a true producer like that, that's okay. You just surround them with what they need to succeed and you let them go. But if you think that producer is going to have the patience to sit in front of a team and manage and grow them, it takes a very unique personality to do that. That's why in so many businesses, those individual salespeople, they don't catapult to the next level very easily.
Yeah. So the other thing I think is important for people to think about when they're trying to understand these sort of different models of leadership and how people lead organizations or lead even a department or a group of people, I'm always interested. One of the first things I want to know is this someone whose style is more to push or to pull? Kind of related to the stuff we've been talking about. So there's a leadership style or a management style where you would say, hey, this is somebody who drives, they demand, they insist, they push. They push the organization, they push the people, they're driving things forward. So it's more of a driving, pushing style. Well, then there's people that their style is to pull. So it's to inspire, it's to coach, it's to collaborate, it's to work side by side with people. It's more participative in the decision making. Hey, what do you people think? What do you think we should do? Whereas the pusher is like, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's what I need you to do. So on the one side, you have drive, demand, insist, push. And on the other end, you have that pull, collaborate, inspire, coach. So I often jokingly refer to as the push, as this is an inspirational, or excuse me, a perspirational style versus an inspirational style. So do you make them sweat? Do you drive, demand, push? Or at the other end, are you more of a collaborator, someone who pulls people forward and gets them going in the right direction, but it's much more of a collaborative style? And so most people will do better working for one or the other, but I would also argue that the most effective managers, the most effective leaders can do both. So I always say a great leader or manager has to be able to use the full range of emotion in order to communicate to other people around them. And so someone who's got a really flat personality, if you're an introvert and you've got a really flat personality and you generally, one of my clients from the South says, the kind of person, they've got the same expression on their face, whether they just won the lottery or their dog died. Okay. Well, that's not somebody who's using the full range of emotion to communicate to others how things are going. So people in the work, people that work with you, they want to know if you're the boss, they want to know how they're doing. So they're constantly looking at you for these cues. Am I doing okay? Am I not doing okay? Is it good? Is it bad? And so someone who's really, much more of a flat affect, people are usually starving for more signals as to how they're doing. They're kind of getting more feedback about, hey, am I doing what I should be doing? Am I making you happy? Because I don't care what kind of organization you have, at the core of it, most of us are interested in making our boss happy. We are managing up to some degree. And if there's not enough feedback, then we're always left a little wanting, or some people are more secure than others. And someone who's a little more insecure may need even more feedback. But you got to be able to use the full range of emotion. And so there's a lot of leadership books, a lot of advice about how should you be? Should you, obviously Steve Jobs was a drive, demand, insist, push person who was tremendously successful. And there are other models of leaders. And there's a lot in popular culture of management that the preferred style would be much more collaborative, pulling. What I've learned is the most effective leaders can toggle between the two. There's a time when they drive, demand, and insist, but they're not stuck there. And they also have the agility to move over into a more collaborative pulling style.
And I've seen that firsthand. It's weird to see how certain people respond differently. That's probably been one of the biggest challenges, I think, in my career, was trying to find a way to navigate the two. Because if it was me alone, I would be pushing and pushing and pushing. But it's not me alone. And as companies grow in scale, you've got to have that pull in. And I've seen it firsthand that it's funny. The one thing that sticks out to me the most is I had an argument with my brother, which led to us not working together anymore. And it largely had a lot to do with the fact that we had different styles as it relates to pushing and to pulling and to how, to your first point, he was the competition driven guy. And when you do that with a partner, that could wind up being a very toxic environment if it's just two people. When you think about it in the context, if there's one person who's starting a business with you and you're motivated by competition, unless you perceive somebody else on the outside as being your competitor, that person you're starting the business with is your competitor.
Yeah. And I've seen it work as a great combination on the other hand, where you can kind of have an inspirational leader. You can have someone who's kind of the soul of the organization, who's really, who lifts people up and has a way of communicating to the organization that is really more inspirational. But they might want, the same person might never be able to sit down and have a hard performance based conversation with a person who isn't cutting it. So for that, so you might have this inspirational leader who's great. Say, okay, well, but who's gonna go talk to Roger and tell him he's not cutting it? And if he doesn't get better, he might not be here next quarter. Well, sometimes the inspirational person's like, okay, that's not me. I'm not gonna do that. And so sometimes there can be a number two, or maybe it's the chief operating officer who's maybe more the detail person, or the person who's really focused on the business metrics and is more of the drive and demand, and they actually work pretty well together. So it can, you know, you can have a complementary style in that way, but that can be tricky too. It can be, that can be a hard dynamic. If you're if you work in that organization, you may be the old saying, I have many gods to pray to. And so sometimes you have very different personalities of the leaders that you respond to, and you may think, okay, well, I got to figure out how to work with both of these people. But sometimes, you know, you can have that inspirational leader and then somebody else who's more of the drive, demand, push, and they actually just combine to create the whole.
So many different ways to do it. It's crazy to me to think that some of these people at the top, the upper echelon of success, are that self-aware. Or do you think that it's just inherently the way they've been successful and they're repeating, you know, this mechanism?
No, I mean, some people are very intentional about it, but I think most of the time it's happenstance. Two people team up together and they happen to complement each other in that way. And they realize that there's some kind of symbiotic relationship that makes them more effective, you know, like Hewlett-Needed Packard, for example. So we can think of these companies that were started by two people, for example, maybe Jobs and Wozniak would be another, maybe a little bit different in terms of creativity and the different things they brought to the table. But I think most of the time it just, and maybe the reason those two people are attracted to each other in the beginning has something to do with that. The old adage of maybe some element of opposites attracting. But I've known a few people that were pretty intentional around, hey, what kind of person do I need to do this with that fills in some of my blank spaces and vice versa. But more often than not, I think it's, if it works or it doesn't work, it's more just more happenstance.
More happenstance than not. Yeah, I get that. I mean, there's so many people. It's funny as well. I keep saying it because there's so many stories that I just keep going through my brain as we're talking about it. You know, when you work with people, you don't necessarily know how they are in the work environment either. I have plenty of friends that I've worked with that have a completely different mindset. One in particular, he was the sweetest dude, you know, great guy. But when it came to working with his employees, his belief was that he had to micromanage everybody.
Right.
And I couldn't for the life of me figure out, I'm like, look, man, like why, how can you be such a nice guy with me? Like such a, you know, loyal friend and a great guy and gregarious and fun. And then be like this regime in your office where everybody has to punch a time card and you have to watch them and, you know, walk around and make sure they're working and be present at all times. I said, how can that be the same guy? But that was just culturally something that he was. You never know what you're going to get sometimes. You really have to kind of work out and go through the wars together and figure out if somebody is the right fit. It's not something you can just instinctually know going into something.
Yeah. And you know, what's the motivation for that? And I've had friendships with a number of people that I never worked for. In fact, most of my friendships that I've made with my clients, these are people that maybe we've worked together, or I've been their coach, and we're friends now. But those are people, there are few of them I'm keenly aware that I really enjoy doing things socially and having them as a friend, but I also am really glad I don't work for them for maybe some of those similar reasons. So, yeah.
No, I totally get it. And we're getting a little long on time. I want to make sure I'm cognizant of your day as well. But if you could sum up some of the experiences that you've had, you know, good or bad, Are most leaders intentional about being a leader? Are most people who are successful, are they intentional about it? I mean, are they going out there and planning this? Everybody always tells you to plan years in the future and have this big master plan. Do you find that people are saying, because if you go online, social media right now, everyone's saying, I'm going to be a millionaire. I'm a self-made millionaire. And they're really projecting a lot of what they are. Do you think having a plan or projecting who you want to be is really what pushes them ahead? Or do you think it's just this unquenchable thirst for success that drives it more than that plan per se?
You know, I think some people are more intentional and planful. And yeah, you can read a lot of stuff about, yeah, you should have a 5-year plan. But even the ability to think 5 years ahead is kind of a leadership ability. Not everybody's wired to think 5 years ahead. So what kind of time horizon do you think in? And it's actually something that has to be cultivated. You have to start thinking in longer term chunks. Some people probably do it more naturally better than others. But I would say most of the world, it's true that most of the world just spends its time scraping stuff off the windshield. Most people, even when I talk to, so one of the questions I always ask a senior executive that I'm talking to them on behalf of one of my clients as a potential candidate. And I'll say, tell me about a typical day. Just take me from the beginning through the end. What's a typical day like for you? And you'd be amazed at some of the most senior level executives that are in purportedly strategic jobs, but their day isn't structured much differently than a fairly close to a frontline manager. Yeah, get up, get into the office, go through my emails, spend the first hour of the day is, you know, just kind of looking at stuff and going through emails, kind of getting organized. Then they go through a whole bunch of meetings. And then depending on the culture or the company or who they are, you know, they go home, maybe spend a little time with their family, get back on the computer, answer some more emails, do some paperwork. And it really doesn't look much different. It's just more of it. But they're managing their time in the same way. And then I'll say, well, tell me about your planning system. How do you prepare for the day? How do you prepare for the week? And most people are just making simple to-do lists. I mean, it's really not very sophisticated. Occasionally I'll get a person that has a real system for how they look at the year and then how they break this stuff down and how they cascade that back into the four quarters and then what they've got to do this month. But boy, most people are, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there about intentionality and planning things out. I'd say 90% of the world's just kind of grinding away and scraping stuff off their windshield.
That baffles me. I couldn't function that way. I literally could not. I mean, between the real estate company and the law firm and the bank and all these other things that I'm doing, if I went into it that laissez-faire, I would never be able to schedule any. I mean, I've got my calendar's booked up for a solid month. And that's not like a brag. It's just, you know, when you get family too, you layer in that complexity and my wife having three calendars for us, it just winds up being what it is. I can't imagine going through life like that and not being a little bit more thoughtful to it. But I guess it is a bit of an anomalous situation.
Well, and you're a super achiever. I mean, your accomplishments and the number of things that you're doing well are pretty impressive. So
until it's not, recessions have a way of proving that stuff out, right? if everybody can see the look that Roger's giving me right now, nonetheless, I did want to give you a story first before I let you go. So I came home after our conversation at Yale and I thought to myself, like, I'm so used to pushing myself. I want to continue to push. And that conversation, I think in some ways I had gotten into a funk when I originally talked to you, where I believe the rhetoric around me that was really designed to hold me back in some way without people consciously wanting to do it. It was just people in the work world have this naturally competitive space. And because they naturally try to compete, they try to magnify your faults to make themselves feel better in some ways. And I had fallen into this funk of a little bit of like, I was unhappy doing just what I was, but I was afraid to push harder for more. So I came home with the intention and I started the real estate company and then we started the law firm and we really, you know, started pushing things aggressively. And I leveraged the people around me to do that. My father at the law firm, my sister at the real estate company, and my brother at one point in time. And things started to really get going. And it's been this relentless pursuit of, I guess, personal development that came from that, you know, question and answer session that we had, where we went over my own test results and the evaluation that you gave me. And I go back to that thing a lot. And it's really helped me kind of self-align every 3 months, every 6 months. And this is not me selling your service. This is just me telling you what it's done for me. And because of that, I knew that I needed some level of a creative outlet that was a different challenge for me that related to more people and cast a wider net. And going back to it a couple months ago, that's how the podcast idea came up. I felt that I didn't get a chance to connect with people like you and people that were out there, and I didn't get a chance to really feel and grow personally. And I thought, well, if I want to do that for me, maybe we could share it with other people. So it all essentially came back to that session that we had back at Yale. I think a lot about it. I can't thank you enough for your friendship, for the wisdom that you've imparted on me, and for your equal fan of BMW, your love for BMWs and pizza and beer. I mean, tell everybody what you just bought. Everybody deserves to know. It's gorgeous.
So I got a new BMW, an M550i. And it's like a funny story. I said that I read an article about this car in the Wall Street Journal. And on the online version of the journal, there's this color picture of this car. And it was this fantastic metallic green color, not a lime green, darker than that. I always say it kind of reminds me if you looked into the eye of a fly, that kind of iridescent green. And I just was fascinated by the color. And so I decided I wanted one of these cars and I wanted it in that color. And the punchline is it turns out it was a special order and it wasn't easy to get that color. I had to wait extra time for it. And I had to do some special paperwork. It was one of these things that say, hey, once you put in this order for this special custom color, you've bought this car, right? So, so it's like, all right, make sure you're committed to this thing. So yeah, it's great. It's the coolest car I've ever owned, and it's super fun. So thanks for asking.
How's your stunning color?
How's your project coming?
As we were on this call, I just got a picture of the wheels. We had custom vintage BBS wheels built, 17-inch wheels, stunning job, but very, very custom done. I just saw the photos. We actually held off from going to SEMA this year because, you know, we weren't sure what SEMA was going to be. I didn't want to rush it. We found some, I think I told you this, but the body, we did some digging on the body where we were doing this full rotisserie restoration. We found that the body had literally at the firewall been held together with cardboard and fiberglass.
Yeah, you sent me some pictures of the paper mache.
I have no idea how that thing held together. I'm glad we found it. I'm glad we fixed it. I'm glad we decided to get to the level that we did. But we also found a lot of stuff along the way. It allowed us to reinforce it. It's a beautiful car. It's going to be stunning. There's nothing like it that's out there right now. But we also didn't want to rush it. So we got a lot of custom billet pieces made with the logos and the brand on it. It'll likely go to SEMA next year. But we decided to pull back and do it right just because I'm so afraid. For those people out there who don't know, I've had projects go south for SEMA multiple times. And it always comes down to us rushing things when we really shouldn't have.
Well, it's funny because you had given me the date of SEMA and you said, hey, so you're going to come. And I had a conflict in my calendar and I was just waiting for you to tell me, hey, so just remember SEMA's coming up in a few weeks and, you know, I expect you to be there. And so it's funny. I never called and said, hey, how come we're not going to SEMA? Yeah, but I was going to leave because I had this conflict on my calendar. So I'm glad you're not going until next year because I want to see it.
It was so emotional pulling out of that. I mean, it's on YouTube. I posted a video, like almost like a vlog, explaining the trip up to Sacramento and seeing Igor, the guy who's building the car for me at CA Tuned, and pulling out. It's always emotional because you get this big wind up. There's money, there's time, there's energy, there's other people involved in it. There's sponsors. In our case, we only had two by design, so we didn't have to worry about, you know, appeasing everybody else. But it was difficult. So we pulled out of that, but the car is going off to paint shortly, and we have everything already done. It's so well done at this point that it's just going to be a stunning vehicle. I have no doubt that the time will be well spent. But man, heart broke my heart again. But I didn't forget about you. I still love you. We're still going to go. And I chose not to go this year because my mom is actually going to be in Vegas with my sister next week. So we're going to go out there.
Nice. All right.
Yeah.
Well, hey, this has been great.
It has been. So before I let you go, how can people find you? If they want to get in touch with you or they're interested in the here or possibly, making some changes to their life and getting more into this with you, how do they reach out? How do they connect? How do they find Roger?
Yeah, the easiest way is to find me on LinkedIn. And it's Roger Lipson, the Lipson Group. If you Google it, you'll find me as well. So I have a fairly quiet presence out there on the web because most of what I do is by referral. But you can find me if you look me up.
Well, and before I let Roger go, I will say he's being incredibly humble. This man's resume is damn good, and he's not dropping names because he can't and he doesn't, but there's a lot of powerful people that rely on him for his decision-making and his opinion on how they should operate. So I would say don't let his humility fool you. The man's connected. So thank you so much for everything. Appreciate you, Roger. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation on the Higher Standard Podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe or follow on whatever platform you are listening to this on. If you like this episode, please write a review and share it with us. We are getting the show up and running right now, so every message, every review, and every note counts. This show exists to showcase what's possible when leaders decide to uphold a higher standard for their businesses, their investments, their families, and most importantly, themselves. If you want to see more of my content, I post daily on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, so be sure to follow me on your favorite social media platform. And with that, it is a wrap. And as always, I look forward to hanging with you all on the next episode.